Chapter the 10th. I badly wanted to scream, and under the circumstances I certainly had every right to do so. However, any such ululation might have attracted attention of a most unwelcome sort from the house. Somehow I retained sufficient presence of mind to utter only a squeak as I plummeted. Also, somehow perhaps because my extremity of terror shot new strength into me, without taking credit for any conscious virtue in the matter, I am grateful to say that somehow I kept hold of the rope. Within a moment, a long moment it seemed, but in fact only several horrified heartbeats, almost at once that blessed lifeline broke my fall. My carpet-bag had, after all, caught in the beech tree, and with a gasp I found myself swinging in mid-air, convulsively clutching the rope with both hands. However, as my strength was all but gone, I slipped downward. But even whilst swinging in such a manner, one can manipulate one's arc by leaning one's personage this way or that. Doing so, in a moment I landed with the rope still in my hands, and with the appearance of being in full control of my descent, giving barely a thump as I collapsed to the ground just where I wanted to be, near the edge of the sunk fence, but on the other side from where I had begun. "Enola, what in the name of heaven are you doing?" whispered my brother explosively. "Yes, I assure you this is possible," from the ditch. "Is it not obvious?" I panted, for how could he not see? I had crossed the ha-ha, and as soon as I had caught my breath, I would proceed to the house. "It is obvious only that our mother gave birth to an Amazon." Shock vied with, I think and hope, admiration in his voice. "Why did you not tell me you had a rope? Secure it to something quickly, then give it here so I can lift myself out of this confounded ditch." His tone, quite accustomed to being obeyed before he could snap his fingers, failed to move me. Without, again, taking credit for any conscious virtue in the act of defiance, I responded not at all, simply because I had so thoroughly exhausted myself. "The rope, Enola?" "I think not," I replied blandly, my breathing somewhat more under control. "After I get back, perhaps."
"What? Back from where?"
"From locating, and, if at all possible, freeing the unfortunate Lady Cecily. Would you happen to know in which room she is imprisoned?"
"In the most inaccessible apex of the North Tower."
He meant to discourage me, I think, and realized too late, as I sat up to dust myself off and prepare for action, that he had offered me an irresistible challenge instead.
"Enola, you cannot!"
"I am not sure I can," I admitted, "but I certainly intend to try."
"It is simply not possible."
"Why? You intended to do it, before you ran afoul of the sunk fence. How did you plan to accomplish it?"
"Assist me out of this damnable ditch, and perhaps I will show you."
My tone quite gentle in contrast to his, I said, "Not until you give me your promise."
"What?"
"Promise me upon your honour that you will let me be, and will make no attempt to apprehend me or to constrain me." Silence. A good sign, I realized, for Sherlock Holmes would make no promise lightly. And if he gave his word, he would abide by it without fail. Indeed, if only, if we could be friends. Deep within me commenced the most peculiar fluttering sensation, as if a butterfly had split open the chrysalis of my heart. Indeed, I felt my pulse begin to throb so hard that I could hear my own heart beating. Almost too late, I realized it was not so. What I could hear in that silence was footsteps. Behind me and off to one side, someone walking. Someone had come out of the house, and was approaching nearer by the moment. My reaction was instantaneous, and, I admit, contrary to reason. I tossed the rope to Sherlock, hissing, "Shh! Stay down!" The rope, vertical against the tree behind it, should not be noticed in the night. My brother should escape detection. But where, pray tell, was I to hide? Instinctively I cowered, flattening myself to the ground, but what more to do I could not think.
"Don't like it, I tell you,"
said a deep, dark voice I recognized. It was the massive man who had quite terrified a certain midden-picker, and who consorted most incongruously with orphans.
"I haven't heard Lucifer make a sound for the past hour." Because the dog isn't barking, you roused me out of bed. The second voice, also male, sounded childishly wrought. Really, Father?
Don't pout at me, Bramwell. It's for your sake we're taking all these precautions.
Bramwell, the Baron of Merganza's son and heir. Then the big brute of a man was indeed, as I had concluded, the Baron himself. With fascinated horror, I watched as father and son emerged from between the beech trees. Both carried heavy walking sticks by way of weapons. The son, Bramwell, had a burly physique similar to that of his mastiff-like father, but in the younger man's case it made him resemble a toad, as did his face, what I could see of it in the gaslit night. Small wonder he had not managed to win a bride in any gentlemanly way. Father and son made towards the mastiff's quarters, and at once the Baron roared,
"See! Someone's been feeding him!"
Dramatically, he pointed at the soup bone I had flung over the fence.
"Someone's poisoned him!"
"No, they haven't poisoned your darling Lucifer. Can't you hear the brute snore? He's in his bed, sleeping." Facing the mastiff's house, they stood with their backs to me, and I took the opportunity to retreat as noiselessly as possible, scooting away hind end foremost like a crustacean going under a rock so that I could continue watching them.
"As I should be asleep in mine," added Bramwell pettishly.
"Stop being a donkey! Poison or a sleeping powder, it means the same. Someone is trying to get in."
"So?"
"Someone is prying into our affairs."
"And what if they do? What if they pry their way right into the tower? All they'll find there is a stable boy dressed as a girl."
"Shut your mouth!"
The Baron's fury froze me motionless in the shadows. The way he turned on his son, I really thought for a moment that he would strike him. But instead he growled,
"Not another word of that, do you understand me? Reply!"
In a subdued tone, Bramwell said,
"Yes, Father."
"We must arm ourselves with pistols, then search the grounds. Come along!"
"Yes, Father."
Meekly, Bramwell followed as the Baron strode towards the house. Even as they did so, movement from the other direction caught my eye. Swarming up the rope, hand over hand, as smartly as any sailor, Sherlock lifted himself from the ditch, crawling out upon the side away from me, towards the fence. Quite sensibly, then, having concluded from Bramwell's words, as I had, that Lady Cecily was not after all to be found in the tower, he intended to make his escape. Good. Fervidly wishing to do likewise, I stayed where I was, flat on the ground behind the nearest tree trunk, waiting for him to depart, for I knew him to be a fox, in his way as much a danger to me as the irate Baron and his unlovely son. Sherlock rose to his feet, or rather his uninjured foot, for the other, wrapped in the bandaging with which I had supplied him, showed all too clearly and unfortunately white in the night, and that pale, bloated L barely touched the ground. He placed hardly any weight on the foot at all. Seriously lame, he must get away as quickly as possible. Naturally, then, I expected him to limp towards the fence. At once. But instead, wobbling on one leg, he scanned the yard and gave a muted call. "Enola!" Confound him! Shadowed and in hiding, I clenched my fists in frustration that he would not let me alone. Yet at the same time I felt that benighted butterfly fluttering in my heart. "Enola, come here. I'll not leave without you." He quite meant it, I could tell, as indeed I should have realized all along, for Sherlock Holmes was a true gentleman, that is to say, incapable of sensible behavior under such circumstances. Muttering the naughtiest words I knew, I rose to my feet, yanking knots out of my skirt. What a wretched time to feel shy! But I would not face my brother with my knees bared. Rife with the strangest emotions, I ran towards him while my much-rumpled brown tweed arranged itself to cover my lower limbs to the ankles. With only the sunk fence between us, I stared at Sherlock, intent on every nuance of his face. But he gave me scarcely a glance. "Enola, quick!" He tossed me the rope. Catching it, I stood where I was, studying him for some indication, some sign. Still, he had not given me any promise, you see. Nor would he. He only stared back at me, his chiseled face like marble, something in his gaze imploring me, yet daring me, to trust him, if only for this one hour of this one night.
"Confound you, Sherlock Holmes," I told him, and I took the dare. Reaching above my head to grasp the rope that hung down from the beech tree, I swung across the ha-ha to land lightly by his side.